File 50.
A serious state of economic disruption was being brought about by the slow elimination of the personal control of vested interests and the gradual transference of the whole economic structure into the hands of joint stock companies. In this way, labour became degraded into an object of speculation in the hands of unscrupulous exploiters. The depersonalisation of property ownership increased on a vast scale. Financial exchange circles began to triumph and made slow but sure progress in assuming control of the whole of national life. Before the war, the internationalisation of the German economic structure had already begun by the roundabout way of share issues. It is true that a section of the German industrialists made a determined effort to avert the danger, but in the end they gave way before the united attacks of money-grabbing capitalism, which was assisted in this fight by its faithful henchmen in the Marxist movement. The persistent war against German heavy industries was the visible start of the internationalization of German economic life as envisaged by the Marxists. This, however, could only be brought to a successful conclusion by the victory which Marxism was able to gain in the revolution. As I write these words, success is attending the general attack on the German state railways, which are now to be turned over to international capitalists. Thus, international social democracy has once again attained one of its main objectives. The best evidence of how far this commercialization of the German nation was able to go can be plainly seen in the fact that when the war was over, one of the leading captains of German industry and commerce gave it as his opinion that commerce as such was the only force which could put Germany on its feet again. This sort of nonsense was uttered just at the time when France was restoring public education on a humanitarian basis, thus doing away with the idea that national life is dependent on commerce rather than ideal values. The statement which Stinnes broadcast to the world at that time caused incredible confusion. It was immediately taken up and has become the leading motto of all those humbugs and babblers, the statesmen whom fate let loose on Germany after the revolution. One of the worst evidences of decadence in Germany before the war was the ever-increasing habit of doing things by halves. This was one of the consequences of the insecurity that was felt all round, and it is to be attributed also to a certain timidity which resulted from one cause or another. And the latter malady was aggravated by the educational system. German education in pre-war times had an extraordinary number of weak features. It was simply and exclusively limited to the production of pure knowledge and paid little attention to the development of practical ability. Still less attention was given to the development of individual character, insofar as this is ever possible, and hardly any attention at all was paid to the development of a sense of responsibility, to strengthening the will and the powers of decision. The result of this method was to produce erudite people who had a passion for knowing everything. Before the war, we Germans were accepted and estimated accordingly. The German was liked, because good use could be made of him. But there was little esteem for him personally, on account of this weakness of character. For those who can read its significance aright, there is much instruction in the fact that among all nationalities, Germans were the first to part with their national citizenship when they found themselves in a foreign country. And there is a world of meaning in the saying that was then prevalent. With the hat in the hand, one can go through the whole country. This kind of social etiquette turned out disastrous when it prescribed the exclusive forms that had to be observed in the presence of His Majesty. These forms insisted that there should be no contradiction whatsoever, but that everything should be praised which His Majesty condescended to like. It was just here that the frank expression of manly dignity, and not subservience, was most needed. Civility in the presence of monarchs may be good enough for the professional lackey and place-hunter. In fact, for all those decadent beings who are more pleased to be found moving in the high circles of royalty than among honest citizens. These exceedingly humble creatures, however, though they grovel before their lord and bread-giver, invariably put on airs of boundless superciliousness towards other mortals, which was particularly impudent when they posed as the only people who had the right to be called monarchists. This was a gross piece of impertinence, such as only despicable specimens among the newly ennobled or yet to be ennobled could be capable of. And these have always been just the people who have prepared the way for the downfall of monarchy and the monarchical principle. It could not be otherwise. For when a man is prepared to stand up for a cause, come what may, he never grovels before its representative. A man who is serious about the maintenance and welfare of an institution will not allow himself to be discouraged when the representatives of that institution show certain faults and failings, and he certainly will not run around to tell the world about it, as certain false democratic friends of the monarchy have done. But he will approach His Majesty, the bearer of the crown himself, to warn him of the seriousness of a situation, and persuade the monarch to act. Furthermore, he will not take up the standpoint that it must be left to His Majesty to act as the latter thinks fit, even though the course which he would take must plainly lead to disaster. But the man I am thinking of will deem it his duty to protect the monarchy against the monarch himself, no matter what personal risk he may run in doing so. If the worth of the monarchical institution be dependent on the person of the monarch himself, then it would be the worst institution imaginable, for only in rare cases are kings found to be models of wisdom and understanding and integrity of character, though we might like to think otherwise. But this fact is unpalatable to the professional knaves and lackeys. Yet all upright men, and they are the backbone of the nation, repudiate the nonsensical fiction that all monarchs are wise, etc. For such men, history is history, and truth is truth, even where monarchs are concerned. But if a nation should have the good luck to possess a great king or a great man, it ought to consider itself as specially favoured above all the other nations, and these may be thankful if an adverse fortune has not allotted the worst to them. It is clear that the worth and significance of the monarchical principle cannot rest in the person of the monarch alone, unless heaven decrees that the crown should be set on the head of a brilliant hero, like Frederick the Great, or a sagacious person like William the First. This may happen once in several centuries, but hardly oftener than that. The ideal of the monarchy takes precedence of the person of the monarch, inasmuch as the meaning of the institution must lie in the institution itself. Thus, the monarchy may be reckoned in the category of those whose duty it is to serve. He, too, is but a wheel in this machine, and as such he is obliged to do his duty towards it. He has to adapt himself for the fulfilment of high aims. If, therefore, there were no significance attached to the idea itself, and everything merely centred around the sacred person, then it would never be possible to depose a ruler who has shown himself to be an imbecile. It is essential to insist upon this truth at the present time, because recently those phenomena have appeared again, and were in no small measure responsible for the collapse of the monarchy. With a certain amount of native impudence, these persons once again talk about their king, that is to say, the man whom they shamefully deserted a few years ago at a most critical hour. Those who refrain from participating in this chorus of lies are summarily classed as bad Germans. They who make the change are the same class of quitters who ran away in 1918 and took to wearing red badges. They thought that discretion was the better part of valour. They were indifferent about what happened to the Kaiser. They camouflaged themselves as peaceful citizens, but more often than not they vanished altogether. All of a sudden, these champions of royalty were nowhere to be found at that time. Circumspectly, one by one, these servants and counsellors of the crown reappeared to resume their lip service to royalty, but only after others that had borne the brunt of the anti-royalist attack and suppressed the revolution for them. Once again they were all there, remembering wistfully the flesh-pots of Egypt, and almost bursting with devotion for the royal cause. This went on until the day came when red badges were again in the ascendant. Then this whole ramshackle assembly of royal worshippers scuttled anew like mice from the cats. If monarchs were not themselves responsible for such things, one could not help sympathizing with them. But they must realize that with such champions, thrones can be lost, but certainly never gained.